I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. The Justice Department revealed a brazen bribery scheme last week, charging 50 people, including Hollywood actresses, university coaches, and exam administrators of fraud of gaming the college admission system. At the center of the scandal that the feds called Operation Varsity Blues is William Rick Singer, who offered his clients something he called the side door to get into selective colleges and universities. It reportedly included cheating on SATs, faking resumes to make the applicant look like a talented athlete, and bribing coaches. Singer pleaded guilty to fraud and racketeering in a scam that apparently involved millions and millions of dollars. It also revealed just how far some parents were willing to go to get their child into a prestigious college and make sure there were no obstacles in their way. It also highlighted the unfairness in the college acceptance system that disadvantages some talented and deserving students. This is our topic for today's Radio Times. Let me introduce our two guests. Madeline Levine is a psychologist, co-founder of Challenge Success, a project at Stanford University's Graduate School of Education. She's the author of The Price of Privilege and also Teach Your Children Well. Madeline Levine, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Nice to be back.
Nice to have you back. And also with us and joining us from the studios of Harvard University is Anthony Jack. He's a junior fellow at the Harvard Society of Fellows, also an assistant professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. His research documents the overlooked diversity among lower-income undergraduates. Author of a brand-new book called The Privileged Poor, How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. And Tony Jack, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
And Tony, let me begin with you, if I could, and then Madeline, I will go to you. And I'm just curious, it's been about a week. We've all had a chance to think about this. I have to say this scandal is both shocking but not surprising as I read it. And I'm curious, Tony, just what your overall response has been.
Similar to you. To me, this is what happens in the dark comes into light eventually. And it really is the tip of the iceberg. And that's a very apt analogy, because this is the part that we finally get to see, right? Many of us knew in our bones that this was happening, that rich people pay their way in. We actually get to see it in great detail about how it happened and how some of the actions are actually illegal. Because this is the part that we see, but it's not necessarily the most pernicious or the most dangerous when we think about access to higher education, right? This is just what we saw in this one scheme. But these parents have been doing things for their children and setting up opportunities for them since the day they were born. These are the sets of parents that have been that stepped across the line to do these things.
Well, let me ask you about parents, Madeline Levine, something you know a lot about. And it does, I mean, these are parents that have been described as snowplow parents. We've heard about helicopter parents who are kind of anxious parents hovering over their children's lives. They're tiger moms, you know, demanding excellence from their children. How do you see these parents?
Anthony, that I liked your dark comes into light, as opposed, I always say they've lanced the boil, that this has all been boiling here and nobody has gotten a good look at it. So the way I see these parents is, meaning that there are so many bigger issues than these 50 families. Mm-hmm. I think this is about the worst thing you can do to your child.
Really?
Total vote of no confidence, right? Like you can't do anything, and you can't even get yourself into a college. I've got to do that for you. So it means it takes every sense of agency away from the child. It turns their parents into criminals. It may turn them into criminals. Who knows? It shows it's never enough. These are really privileged kids. They've had tutors. They've had whatever they need. They don't need a side door into a prestigious school, and I don't think for the most part it's about these kids at all. I think when you see a bumper sticker that says "My kid goes to Yale," it's really saying I'm a fantastic parent, which it shouldn't be, because it should be the child's mistake. Accomplishment means nothing if there's no substance to it. So I see it as a terrible vote of no confidence about your child.
Which raises a whole host of questions. One is this sort of reflected glory, that how your child does is a reflection on how good a parent you are. But as you were saying, Madeline, it's also not trusting your child to make their own way.
R- Right. And, you know, this thing about snowplow parents, here's my take on this, and I think it's critical. The idea that if you take away challenge from your child, you have made life easier and better for them, everything we know about that is wrong. You take away challenge and all the kinds of things that kids come into in life. I didn't get invited to the birthday party. Nobody would sit with me at the table. I'm not going to the ball game that everybody's going with. And if the parent comes in, as they often do, and compensate, I just had a case where a kid wasn't invited to a party. I live in San Francisco. The Warriors are the hot thing. So the family bought a whole bunch of tickets for the Warriors so that the kids wouldn't go to the other party. They'd go to their daughter's party.
Oh, my God. Talk about competition, right?
Well, it's competition, but it's also there's two miserable messages in there. When you're unhappy, buy your way out with money, which is, you know, not a good coping skill for kids. And it doesn't give them any opportunity to develop a sense of efficacy and a sense of self and some competence before you go off to college. It does all of the opposite of that, which is to say, I'll take care of it. You're not capable of taking care of it. And I'm going to make sure that that you don't develop the kinds of skills. I call this accumulated disability. These kids who time after time after time have somebody intervene for them are not learning the basic coping skills of getting through life.
Well, the reason we wanted the two of you on is Madeline, you have looked at privileged children, and Tony, you have written a book about the privileged poor, and it also, you're the first generation in your family to go to college. You went to Amherst. You're now at Harvard. And I wonder, just as a student who didn't have these privileges, how that experience has been for you.
It's actually interesting because it goes back to the snowplow parenting, and I think it's interesting that people like to have a catchphrase. But to me, what I see, especially as someone who was first in their family to go to college who didn't have these resources, this isn't snowplow parenting or helicopter parenting. This is opportunity hoarding 101. These are people who are taking advantage of their position in society to hoard opportunities and resources for their children to take whatever step needed to secure advantage for them. And I think it does. I think you are right that it does put students at a disadvantage developmentally. But these students are not innocent either, because oftentimes when they get to school, and especially these are things that I heard, they try to then weaponize affirmative action against lower income first gen and or students of color and say that you got in because of what you are, not what you can do. So to me, to talk about this controversy without also bringing in the issue of race to the forefront, also, I think, minimizes what the students and the families as a whole do. They have had so much laid out for them, the neighborhoods they choose, the schools they attend, which have resources that rival colleges. They have tutors that cost $250 an hour. They have essay writers who help, I'm putting in bunny ears, write their essays, if not write the essays themselves. And then when people talk about the experiences of lower income students, they say that we overmatch. Hmm. We go to schools that are above our punching weight, especially if we are Black, Latinx, and or low income. But the question is, if you've had all these resources, who is overmatching now? Right? Who doesn't have the test scores to talk about these to get into the school that you have to bribe people and pay people to test for you? So when I think about this experience, this scandal in the context of being a first generation college student, it does bring up issues of racial inequalities. Sure. Also, especially how they weaponize affirmative action. You took someone else's spot. Like, they believe that they have proprietary ownership of every spot at an elite college. So if a Black, Latinx, or low-income and or first-generation college student gets in, you're taking a spot from somebody more deserving, yet you have not earned that spot. You have been bought that spot.
Well, and Tony, I'm curious about, and Madeline, I'll get to you in just a second. Tony, I'm just curious about, were you told directly that you were, in a sense, an affirmative action baby or an affirmative action student when you were at Amherst or even Harvard?
This is what I said, like, the unfortunate, unacceptable rite of passage for many students of color in the latter upper mobility. I heard this in high school when I got into Amherst. I heard it at Amherst. I heard it when I got into Harvard. I heard it when I accepted the position at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Though it comes in different forms, this is something that resonates with so many, and not just people of color, but also, you know, a lot of women say this, say similar things when they get promoted. Oh, they just needed another woman on the board when you are the first one. They just needed a woman, as if to try to undercut all the efforts and all the work that you did to get into the position to be selected, right? These are statements that we actually made, and it's not just those who are more conservative. A lot of people who consider themselves liberal and the children of very wealthy parents believe that they earned their spot. I'm not saying that they didn't do any work, but what I'm saying is what this scandal puts into context is all the work that their families do to give them a head start in a race that they think that they are beginning at the starting line. And that's just that's fundamentally not true.
Madeline, I know you want to say something. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, Anthony, the tutors for that group of people run $1,000 an hour, not $250 an hour.
Okay. So stand corrected.
I was being a little generous.
You were.
So, you know, I'd make the case that which it can be hard to do right now when you're not feeling any empathy towards this group of kids, but I'd make the case that both of these groups of kids are disabled by the current system. And when I said it's like lancing the boil, that's because our entire college admission system is broken. I know you're going to have somebody else talk about college scholarships. The only people actually, and I know you know this, Anthony, the only people who benefit from attending a selective school as opposed to a good school are inner city black kids and first generation immigrants. So at Challenge Success, we actually have a white paper, which I can, if you don't mind, challengesuccess.org. We have a white paper that has looked at all of the effects on rankings versus what we call fit. And we find that people do not benefit. This group of kids don't need this college. They will do just fine in a place where they belong. And, you know, you're setting them up for a kind of failure as well, which is you're putting them in a place they're not prepared for, where they know that their way has been bought in. And I want to say something about these families. And it's
well, you know what, if you don't mind, only because we're about 10 seconds from our break here. So let me just quickly reintroduce you. We'll pick up on the conversation after this very short break. And again, that's Madeline Levine. She's a psychologist, co-founder of Challenge Success, a project at Stanford University's Graduate School of Education. Wrote a book called The Price of Privilege and Teach Your Children Well. Anthony Tony Jack joining us as well. He's a junior fellow at the Harvard Society of Fellows, assistant professor of education at Harvard Graduate School. He's got a new book called The Privileged Poor, How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. You can join our conversation 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoyne talking with our guests about what lessons we are drawing from the college bribery scandal, what can we do to fix the college admission system, and certainly the scamming or gaming of the college admission system that was revealed in the indictments of last week. And again, our guests are Madeline Levine and Anthony Tony Jack. Madeline, you were talking about the fact that first generation college students and students of color, even students from disadvantaged schools, right, or even communities or neighborhoods, do better at these elite universities. And why is that?
Well, I want to be clear, because I know Tony will have something to say about it. This is, I think they have a very, very hard time. And it's evidenced in the fact that graduation rates are low,
right,
because college is not simply about brain power. College has also got a whole set of unwritten rules about how to behave and what you do in your spare time and all those kinds of things. So there are a few programs that really address the social and cultural parts of going into an entirely different environment, but not enough. And so a lot of these kids go off one at a time. They have no support. They have nobody to talk to. and they do poorly. On the other hand, a lot of the kids on the other end of the spectrum do incredibly poorly as well. Hmm. One of my very good friends said the worst mistake he ever made in his life was getting his kid into Harvard. Because the kid knows that this is not his accomplishment, and it just adds to the sense of being impaired, which often looks like entitlement. You know, some of these very wealthy kids look, for all the world, entitled. And I think you got to remember, if your parents have cheated for you to get into college, this is not the first time they've cheated on anything, right? This is like a way of being in the world, which is bribing people, cheating at work, cheating on your family, cheating on your spouse. I can promise you that somebody who is willing to do this has dirty hands long before this ever happened. And that's the modeling that's going on for some of these kids. And I think it's because we have absolutely no center of values right now between what's going on in politics, the lack of going to church, the lack of spending 2 hours a week in anything that says there's a whole bunch of things in life that matter besides your social standing, and you have a responsibility to take care of those things. I don't think that's part of our culture anymore.
Tony, let me go back to you. In part of your book, you interviewed a number of students, and you have your own experience being a first-generation college student, the privileged poor, as you describe them, about the experiences that they have when they actually get into some of these elite universities and the kind of disconnect they feel from other students who have just much more wherewithal in order to go home for the holidays, for instance.
Yes. The main point that I want to make through the book is that access isn't inclusion. Even right now, we're focusing so much on who gets into college that we actually forget about what happens when students get on campus. And you're right. Students encounter a hidden curriculum, a system of unset rules and unset expectations that they must navigate. And in the book, The Privileged Poor, I identify two groups of lower-income students. Lower-income students who went to traditional neighborhood schools that are typically underserviced, under-resourced, and overcrowded. And I call those students a double disadvantage because they are low income and they come from those type of high schools that are really very different from what they are going to see in college. But the privileged poor are lower income students who actually go to boarding day and preparatory high schools like Andover, Exeter, St. Paul, those boarding schools that we think about when we think about bastions of privilege. And what I actually show is that colleges hedge their bets. They get students from those schools because they know the hidden curriculum. But with that said, those groups still face barriers because there are social policy. There are policies at the schools that trip them up. Right. So I have a big thing where we want students to engage faculty members, but we never say that. Right. We never actually say things like office hours. We always say when they are, but never what they are. Like very simple things that trip students up. But we also have policies that undercut their academic performance, like closing the dining halls during spring break or having meal plans that outprice lower income students. And food insecurity is a problem on the college campus. The GAO actually just released a report that looked at all the research on food insecurity and estimate that roughly 2 out of 5 students across the country are food insecure while they're in college. And if you are more worried about where your next meal is coming from than studying, how are you going to actually compete with your peers in that exact same way?
Which means you're essentially running out of money before the month is over.
Very much so. And these are just some of the things, because right now we have some amazing examples of programs that help students through the social and the academic. The Georgetown Scholars Program at Georgetown, the Meyerhoff Scholars Program at University of Maryland, Baltimore County. We have programs that can help students through, that actually give students a sense of understanding of what it means to be an undergraduate. But there are also real policy changes that must happen within higher education if it is truly to be more accessible for all students. Things like food insecurity or policies that address it.
Here's an email from Rob who said, just as big a scandal are, quote, legacy admissions, where children of alumni are guaranteed admissions or at least given preferential treatment. Madeline Levine, you want to respond to that? I mean, there's so many pieces of this story, and that certainly is one. And we know of parents who have donated, you know, millions of dollars for a building, and lo and behold, their child gets into that university.
Sure. So I think the thing that has struck me the most over the last week has been the surprise and outrage of parents. I mean, if you work in the sphere, you know that there's all kinds of ways that people get their kids into school. And when I say you lance the boil, it's about the things that Dr. Jack is talking about. It's about the trust and kinds of status things that I'm talking about, but there's also athletics, there's also legacy students. I mean, the whole system, and it is broken. And the more I talk to people, I know Stanford better than mm-hmm. other schools. No, I know my state university where I went to undergraduate the best, which was, I'm also first generation. And I went to a school with a lot of kids who were first generation, and that really helped. Because we all had the same problems, and we all put our money together on Sunday night to get dinner. But it wasn't, you know, it was State University of New York at Buffalo, so it wasn't a cultural shift in the same way. And do I think legacies deserve a space? This is all about, I mean, the one thing we haven't talked about, Tony, is this is all about money. Mm. And so if you can buy a spot, buy a building, it's not enough to be a legacy in a lot of schools. Like, you're a legacy, which means you get looked at, and then somebody comes often, not always, and says, by the way, we need not $8 million for a building, but we need $30,000 for this, and you're a legacy, and that helps. So any idea that this is a meritocracy is wishful thinking.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Madeline Levine. She's a psychologist, co-founder of Challenge Success, author of a couple of books, including The Price of Privilege and Teach Your Children Well. Anthony Tony Jack is with us. He's an assistant professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And he's got a brand new book called The Privilege Poor, How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. And, of course, talking about what many people have been talking about over the last week, the scandal involving admissions. Faking SAT scores, faking athletic prowess, and paying off college coaches. You can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Madeline, let me just quickly go back to you. How, though, do you say to parents who are overly ambitious, whether we call them snowplow parents or what, that good enough is good enough, that it's okay to be, you know, to be a B student. Yeah, you're talking to one here. I was kind of a C and B student.
Yeah. So, you know, part of it's education. Most of the CEOs in this country actually have gone to state schools. My co-founder is a Harvard-Stanford graduate, and I went to the State University of New York at Buffalo in a psychology program you never heard of. And the research is that none of this matters. So they just for people who like data, Kruger and Dale did a study, and they took a look at Yale students. So they're all bright, right? They're all admitted to Yale. And they looked at the kids who went, and then they looked at the kids who didn't go because mom was sick or they didn't want to be away from home or it was too much money. And they looked at these kids. It's longitudinal over a bunch of years, 5 years, 10 years, and wanted to see, was there any difference? There's none. Huh. There is no difference because it's about the kid. We've been sold the idea that the brand of the school is the most important thing that matters, that raises your status, but it doesn't. These kids were indistinguishable from each other because it was all about the kid, not about the parent. It was about the kid, not about the school. And so somehow we've come to believe that brand name schools offer entry into an entirely different world to these kinds of privileged kids who have entry anyway. And now you've deformed them. These are kids who will probably have disproportionate roles in society, and you've deformed their moral center, you've deformed their sense of ethics, you've deformed their sense of identity, and I mean, it's from my point of view, it is absolutely tragic all around. I got to tell you, Marty, I am a little less interested in this group because it's not like this is the first time this has happened. I'm interested in the whole college admissions system, which is broken and is the second greatest cause of stress for students across the socioeconomic state.
Antonia, I know you want to get in on it. Let me just add something here. More students are applying to colleges. Some of them are accepting less students. So there is an incredible amount of pressure on students to perform and to get into their, if not the college of their choice, at least a college that they think will get them somewhere in life.
Yes, but I want to say something to make sure that we're all on the same page. In that study that shows, like, what is the bonus that students get for going to UPenn versus Penn State, if you read all the literature, especially the new research by Christina Eller and Tom Dupree at Columbia University, it shows that for certain groups that holds. But when you are talking about women, when you are talking about students of color and those who are from lower income background, the more selective the school, the greater the chances of upper mobility for a host of factors. These schools have more resources. These schools have greater access to support services or more money for support services for students. So I don't want people to come away with say that, oh, maybe we should go to a lesser tier school because of X, Y, and Z. That's just not true. It is a rat race that everyone is trying to get in.
Go ahead, Tony.
To get into more selective schools, and that is true. More students are applying, and these schools aren't growing in number. The question becomes not just about this admission stuff, but what happens once students get on the campus, because a lot of things that amplify the inequality and social origins is also what their families can do for them as they approach the job market. Because as was said earlier, this process does not stop. It did not start for the application process. It doesn't end there. These are the parents who help their students get internships by calling up a friend. They pay their rent. They give them monthly salaries. They help them get on their feet from day one, right? This is not something that starts in the 11th hour of high school, right? This is not something that is just geared towards getting their students into college. We have a different approach, but I don't want any person to hear like, oh, if I'm first gen or if I'm low income or if I'm any student, that I should go to any school. No, there is a benefit to going to the most selective school or the most resourced school that is a match for you. It is my job, at least how I see it as a sociologist and education researcher, to make sure that schools are not only focusing on access, but focusing on what are the best supports for students that we must build in to the very structure and the culture of the school to make sure that we are not setting students up for the okey-doke once they get on campus.
Yeah, fair enough. Madeline, go ahead, jump in.
No, I was just going to say, I think that's what I said, Tony, that we definitely have found, the research has definitely found it's an advantage for under-resourced kids, first-generation kids. So if it came across as it didn't matter, it does matter for that group of kids. It matters far less, if at all, for highly resourced kids.
Let me read a comment here from Mary. Why is this shocking to people? Families have been donating, she goes on to say, to colleges for decades now. And I think we sort of began by saying shocking but not surprising. And then I think for many people, if you've been paying attention, this should not be a big news. Let me get Maureen from, looks like Jenkintown, to join our conversation. And Maureen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. When I was a high school senior, I was National Merit qualified, and I got in the mail, unasked and unsought for, a letter from CW Post offering me a full ride, room and board, 4 years. I turned it down and never told my parents. I just felt that I would be miserably out of place. I felt that they were probably trying to add a little leaven to the bread since their students are so rich, and I just felt instinctively I'd be very unhappy. I went to Bucks County Community College, which was wonderful, and Temple, which was also wonderful, and I had a successful career as a technical editor, and I've never regretted it.
That's so interesting. Maureen, at the age of 18, you figured that out?
Yes.
Yes, she says.
Because I was living in a neighborhood that was above our wealth level, right. And it was made clear to me in high school every day that I was not one of the ones. And I just thought, you know, college is going to be this plus worse if I go to CW Post. So that it wasn't my intelligence. It was more the experience I had in high school that made me realize that this would be a bad experience. It would just continue, it would be in spades.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Tony, we have about a minute and a half before we have to say goodbye to you. And you talk about how for first-generation students, going to a place like Harvard can be a good experience. But the question is, what kind of supports do those students need in order to be able to take advantage of what is offered and also turn that into a successful move in their life? In about a minute, can you summarize that?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important that we, and I'll keep saying this, move from just thinking about thinking beyond the financial aid package. One of the things that I want colleges to do is to understand the full diversity in front of them and understand how they need to change too. Something as simple as defining office hours gets people thinking about what we take for granted on a college campus. Programs are good. Pre-orientation programs are good. They can help students get a localized knowledge, but we need to think about how we can shift our understanding and be better informed about the needs of all our students. Are we prepared to help all of our students through the struggles and the triumphs of being a student? Something as simple as defining office hours gets people to think about what we take for granted, about not just what our students know, but then it gets people thinking about what our students can afford. And then it thinks about what do we need to do to fully support all of our students.
Well, we're going to have to end on that note. Anthony Jack, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's an assistant professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And again, he's got a new book called The Privileged Poor, How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. And Madeline Levine staying with us for the rest of the hour. We'll be talking with Richard Eckstein after this very short break, focusing more on sports and coaches. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've been talking about Operation Varsity Blues, the fraud and bribery scandal involving wealthy parents involved in schemes to cheat on college entrance exams and also pay off coaches. We want to focus now on why the college sports recruiting system is ripe for abuse. Madeline Levine staying with us for the rest of the hour. Again, she's a psychologist, a co-founder of Challenge Success, a project at Stanford University's Graduate School of Education. Also with us is Richard Eckstein. He's a professor of sociology at Villanova University. His research focuses on youth sports commercialization, rising costs of higher education, and intercollegiate athletics spending. And Rick Eckstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
So what does this scandal reveal about college sports to you?
Well, I think the interesting thing, and Tony and Madeline have been hammering on it pretty well, is that this really is the tip of the iceberg. It's almost just a kind of caricature of business as usual. And the business as usual doesn't usually get much attention, doesn't get much feedback. There's not much opposition to business as usual when it comes to the admissions process, and especially how recruited athletes have a noted advantage in getting some of these sort of set-aside slots.
Do coaches have too much authority over who gets accepted into a college or university?
I don't know if putting the blame on the coaches is the issue here. There's a systemic issue that universities have elevated intercollegiate athletics to a point where they're reliant on them in some ways for two things that your guests have been talking about. One is the branding issue, and that sometimes gets tied to sports, how schools project themselves and the way they want people to think about them. And the second is to, in some ways, manipulate admissions and admission statistics to give the appearance that they're more selective than they actually are. And that also affects the school's brand and makes it more desirable for the people like we're talking about who are into image and into brand.
Rick, let me ask you, and I don't know if there's an answer to this, because I'm thinking if I were one of those students and my parents said I was a really good tennis player, or golf player, and I don't play the sport, I get accepted in the college, I go to the athletic director to play what? Play a sport and I sit on the bench all season? I don't understand sort of how that happens or how that doesn't happen.
Well, it sounds kind of odd and unusual laying it out that way, but a lot of college rosters, and this is at all divisions, Division 1, 2, 3, they're so large. They have so many people on them because schools like to have athletes for a variety of reasons we could get into in a little while. Again, it helps their admissions portfolios. And there's a lot of people right now who were admitted who are real athletes and who have played these sports for a long time. And most of these athletes in the non-revenue sports are coming from above the median family income. These are not poor people getting an opportunity to go to college. These are wealthier families who've had the opportunity to access a youth sports system that is incredibly skewed toward the wealthy. And so there are a lot of people right now sitting on benches not playing for 2, 3, 4 years. The dropout rate from college sports teams is pretty phenomenal. And a colleague and I are looking into that right now, although it's kind of tough to track down. So there's a lot of people sitting around not playing right now who do have a pedigree that's reasonable, as opposed to having never lifted a pole vault or never played tennis.
Madeline, let me get you back in on the conversation. I heard you chortle talking about, how a child, I guess, can feel like a fraud if they have been, in a sense, sold to a college or university saying they have a particular athletic skill, but they don't have it. And there they are, you know, sitting on the bench or somehow sitting in the college athletic director's office.
Right. So most people are pretty sympathetic with these kids. I'm a little bit less so because I think that most of them had, you know, your boards don't go from 1,200 to 1,600 and you don't notice that, or you don't notice that all of a sudden you're taking the SATs at home. Or in my neighborhood right here, we had one of these kids who got in on a football scholarship from a school called Marin Academy, where people wear T-shirts that say, we've never lost a football game in 50 years because they don't have a football team. So it's like a joke. And yet this kid was admitted on a football scholarship. So my take is a fair number of these kids actually knew what was going on, participated in it, because that is the kind of world we're living in. It's never enough. You can never have good enough status. You can never have high enough status. You can never have enough bragging rights, called the hedonic treadmill in psychology. It's just you're comparing yourself to the people around you, and you're always coming up short. And so we're talking about 17-year-olds when all of this is going on. So this idea that you cheat the system any way you can, every man for themselves, you know, the world is kind of screwed right now, and you've got to take care of your own and do whatever you can, is a miserable agenda for young people who are when do you develop a moral compass? Remember college, you're sitting around and you're talking about the world and what's wrong with the world. These kids are I think, going to be stymied in their ability to feel authentic, right? That's one of the tasks of a young adult, is to start to feel authentic and to know who they are. And it's all a fraud. So you feel like, you know, no confidence. You can't manage in the world on your own. I mean, your parents have just said to you, listen, honey, you probably couldn't do any of this on your own, so I'm going to take care of it for you. I can't. From my point of view, it is like crazy, and I don't use that word.
You're a psychologist, right?
Yeah, I'm a psychologist, but it is like a mass delusion that, one, these things make a great deal of difference in the lives of kids like this, and two, that people don't understand how damaging this is to child development.
Rick, let me go back to you. You're on a campus at Villanova University and have looked at this issue from so many different vantage points. What do you see as a way to improve the system overall?
Well, a couple of things. First, I'm going to leave the psychology to Madeline because she knows it. So for a sociologist, what I'm most interested in this whole process is how college sports, especially at elite schools, serves to reproduce social inequality from generation to generation by giving opportunities for these sometimes scholarships and sometimes admissions advantages predominantly and disproportionately to non-poor families. So you've got it's kind of funny in a way that you've got these rich people in this situation taking advantage of other rich people, or at least not poor people. But in terms of dealing with it, I mean, there are ways that you could do it. You would have to, you know, since I'm trying to make a systemic argument and a systemic analysis, the system and the structure of both higher education and intercollegiate sports would have to change. We'd have to cut down on the recruitment process. Recruitment is kind of ground zero at the college level for the encouragement of this to happen. And recruitment tends to take place more and more in what are called the showcase tournaments, which is also the epicenter of the youth sports industry. And that's where the two worlds collide.
Yeah.
And as long as colleges are recruiting and college coaches are recruiting people at these showcase tournaments, the youth sports industry will continue to revolve around it. And that's why it's a pay-to-play industry. You have to join teams and clubs that are oriented toward getting to these showcase tournaments where the college coaches show up. You know, it used to not be done this way. It used to be you'd fill a college sports team when I was going to college, probably when Madeline was going to college, with tryouts. And people would come to school, and you'd put a poster up, and you'd have tryouts. But as intercollegiate athletics has increased in importance at higher education, now there's the emphasis on winning. And you hear the kind of platitudes about developing the whole person and paying attention to physical education as well as to textbook education and moral education. It's kind of hard to swallow as the emphasis increases on wins and losses. And, you know, to some degree, I think that's what we saw with maybe with Phil Martelli getting fired recently.
Yeah, from St. Joe's. Rick, let me go back to you. But we know that winning teams make alumni happy. Happy alumni get connected to their college or university. They are donors, supporters of the university. I mean, we talk about how money is kind of embedded in our whole conversation this hour. But how do you see that?
Yeah, the research is a little mixed on whether winning teams really increase donations in the long run from alumni. It's unclear whether any boost that you get is sustainable. There is some evidence that increase in alumni donations for athletics is a zero sum, and it takes away from alumni donations just in general. But the research is mixed on it. What's pretty clear is that where the research isn't mixed is that former varsity athletes contribute at a higher rate than those who weren't athletes. Either it's an affinity that they have for the program. I think we saw that at Temple a couple of years ago when they were talking about eliminating a few programs, and some of the alums who rode and played baseball really, really stepped up. And it's also partly, again, these aren't folks who are coming from poorer areas. They're not disadvantaged people in these non-revenue sports.
Right.
Football and men's basketball are a little bit different. That's why we're not seeing them, I think, in this current scandal. So the money, there's a whole business model with higher ed, you know, that they rely on money from former customers to keep the doors open, which is a very odd business model, which I don't think our doctors and others really employ. So it's an interesting situation.
It sure is, and that's Richard Eckstein, also with us, Madeline Levine, and you can join our conversation. We've covered a lot of territory. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What do you think are some of the solutions to the scandal that was revealed last week involving parents and coaches and fake SAT scores and fake athletic prowess? Here's a comment from Cadence, who says, how might free college for all shift the paradigm? Madeline, would that shift the paradigm, do you think?
Free college for all?
Yeah.
I'm trying to decide, actually, whether I see this as primarily a college issue or a cultural issue. And, of course, it's not one or the other.
Right.
So do I like the idea of free college? I have three millennial sons, and my last kid just graduated from law school. He and his fiance together have debt of $240,000.
Wow.
That is an outrageous amount of money that they will be paying off for a decade before they can even think about a house or a car or anything else. So I'm very concerned with the amount of debt that kids are accumulating. You know, I have a friend whose kid went to medical school, $250,000 in debt. Is this worth it at the end? I don't know. It means that all development is stymied for a while because at exactly the age where you should be getting out and getting married and buying a house, you can't because you're saddled with debt. So I do like the idea of, I'm not sure we could ever do truly free education because I think as Jack pointed out to us, Dr. Jack, there's far more than just getting your tuition. I mean, you have to live.
Sure.
There are many kids who are supporting their families, who are putting money on the table for their sisters and brothers to have dinner. So I think it has to be bigger than just having your tuition paid. And the other thing is, and this may just be my own cynicism, so take it with a grain of salt, I'm not sure the colleges have really any incentive to change this. It has worked well for them forever. Part of me feels like you have to get parents to on my end, with the privilege, parents to understand how incredibly damaging this point of view is to their children. And I don't know, Rick, do you think the real change on this will come from the institutions, or will it come on a cultural level?
Yeah, that's such a good question. Rick, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know that the institutions want to change. I think they're hoping this is treated as an anomaly, and it kind of loses its steam in a couple of days or a couple of weeks and runs out of legs. Although I would love free college for all too, I don't think it would in any way address this current situation, because it's really not the money so much that's attracting people to these pay-to-play pipelines and to want to play college sports or to want to take advantage of this lubricated admissions process. It really is the prestige, as Madeline has talked about and Tony talked about earlier. I don't know how many parents I talked to in my research that were all about being able to say, my son, my daughter is a varsity this or plays Division I that. And there was one case even, and I heard stories about this from others, where a parent was willing to give extra money to a coach that they could then pass on to their daughter and call it a scholarship because she was not on scholarship on her particular team.
Wow.
And it's a prestige thing. It's not trying to relive your youth and your lost youth as much as riding that wave that my son, my daughter is at Yale, is rowing at Yale, is playing soccer at Yale. And parents seem to get a boost of that. It was one of the biggest surprises of my research was finding that obsession with prestige on the part of the parents. But I don't think colleges are going to change until probably somebody makes them change.
And we're almost out of time here, Rick. Do you think parents will change? I put this to Madeline earlier in the hour. I mean, do you think whatever anxiety it is that's driving those parents to want to put so much pressure on their kids in a lot of ways, do you think that will change?
I don't know. I'm not optimistic after talking to so many parents of so many youth athletes and college athletes. They seem to be entrapped in this belief that if their kids don't go through certain pathways, that somehow they're going to have a life of complete destitution, and that's going to rub off on them somehow. They'll lose their jobs. They'll lose their friends. It's almost to the point of obsession. And I'm not a psychologist, so
right,
I don't understand why people would think that. But it was really striking to see it so strongly.
Well, that's Richard Eckstein. He's not a psychologist, but he's a professor of sociology at Villanova University. Rick, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And Madeline Levine, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Marty.
I appreciate it as well. And she's a psychologist, co-founder of Challenge Success. That's a project at Stanford University's Graduate School of Education. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.